Smell therapy. The science and art of aromatherapy is a large system using smells to aid the spirit, mind, and body. Apart from reading about it, self-experimentation, and some aromatherapy sessions with practitioners, I make no claims of expertise in this field. What I'd like to talk about is smell therapy. I have spent much time smelling flowers. That is one way that I identify them on my forays into the woods. I have found that smelling flowers can greatly change my state of being. Though there is much evidence that supports the healing powers of plant smells, one needs to do little more than walk into a garden to feel the effects. Though there are lots of helpful books, I recommend self-experimentation. By simply walking around, one can find those flowers which are putting out a strong smell. I am drawn to them by color, aura, insect activity, and general energy of the plant, as well as the smell. I get as up close to the flower and admire it a lot, sending it loving energy. I breathe into the flower and then smell back lightly, letting the energy move between the plant and me. Sometimes I ask permission from the plant and take a leaf. By crumbling it up, I can smell any essential oils in the plant. Inside myself, I usually feel a shift of energy, a change of perspective. Each plant species affects me differently. Lavender and sweetgrass relaxes me. Eucalyptus, sage, and tea tree clears my aura and body. Roses, jasmine, and gardenia lifts my spirits and dispels depression. Ganja opens my third eye. There are hundreds of plants, hundreds of smells. The overall influence of this exchange is largely situational. How energized the plant is and what state of being I happen to be in are major factors. It's all very dynamic. The plants go where you need them to be. Color therapy. Color therapy, like aromatherapy, has been refined to a scientific level. For those interested in knowing it in that way, there are many books, teachers, and practitioners to consult. For me, I look at it in a much simpler light, in a personal way. I simply notice that when I go into nature and open my eyes wide, which I must consciously do, for I find my eyes squint and shut down within society's artificial lighting, and take in the splendor of the natural dappled light of the forest, I have entered a new world, a world of extreme beauty. When humans hybridize plants, they have a tendency to create big and flashy varieties. In contrast, I noticed in the woods as my eyes adjust that the beauty of the flowers in nature is subtle, so that you have to get down on your hands and knees to see. Their colors, rather than knock you over the head, are truly appreciated only by sitting and looking for a while, slowing down. It is in this state that you can begin to see and appreciate the delicate shades and patterns of the little flowers all about. All the flowers in a community will not be alike, even if they are the same species. On the contrary, each will be unique. If you take the time, you can see the subtle differences. In that whole process of slowing down and sitting among the plants, one is changed. Literally, the whole woods changes before you. The color therapy moves beyond the flowers to all the shades of green that the plants of the woods display. Oh, what a feeling to walk in the woods and see those infinite shades of green, blue-green, yellow-green, red-green, on and on. It becomes a feast for the eyes. When one goes back to the crudeness of human life, some of that magic stays. Once you know that there is not just one green, you begin to see, to truly see, the spectrum, the infinite blend of colors that make up life. Those colors are energies reaching out to you, pouring into you through your eyes. One definition of human being is hue, meaning light, and man for manifesting beings. Light manifesting beings. We are open to that wide spectrum of light colors, then we become more open, more diverse, and richer. Seeing that infinite flow of colors in the woods clears blockages, connects you to the flow, feeds your inner being. Seeing is believing. The plants can help us to see that by just spending this time with them. Go and see for yourself. See how many shades of green you can experience. That sort of experience will change you. For what you see on the outside, you can feel on the inside. Your spirit will lift, and you will feel the healing power of color. Seeing auras. I can best see auras when the sun is setting and the light changes that time just before dusk. To me, they are a density of light energy around some being or object, a corona, a glow. I find plants to be excellent teachers in this. To fully see a plant's aura, I sit before it and go through a meditation by breathing and clearing my mind. Then I look at the plant with my eyes slightly out of focus. Usually I can feel a slight tickling in the back of my eyes. If the plant is in flower, I concentrate on the flowers. This works for me, but each person needs to tailor different methods to work for them. If you are having problems seeing auras, get with a person who seems to have a good knack for it. They can point out the plants that have a particularly strong aura and give helpful hints. The more you practice, the easier you will see them. The moon often has a very strong auric ring around it. Sometimes it even gives off a rainbow of colors. But why take the time to see auras? Why hasn't this been openly taught to people? The answers to these questions overlap a lot. Our society is very focused on the logical, rational, tangible aspects of the universe. We are very immature in an energetic, right-brained, intuitive sense. Though all sorts of studies have been done to support the existence of auras, it is yet to be accepted by Western science. But with all the changes in the world, it is becoming Western science which is losing its place as the interpreter of reality. Auras provide ways of communicating and seeing that can give us a lot of information about what we're experiencing. As you learn to see auras more and more, you will notice patterns around colors, intensity, and clarity. This can give you a lot of information about it as you're interacting with it. Seeing auras is empowering. It is harder to be deceived, misled, or manipulated when you can see auras. This is particularly true when seeing the auras of humans. To practice this, start with yourself. Stand naked in front of a mirror, turn the lighting down, and blur your eyes toward your image. Notice the different intensities of light around you. Later on, sitting with someone you trust, practice seeing their aura. Over time, this will become second nature to you and a valuable tool as you evolve as a human being. So open yourself to seeing auras. They are all around you in the beauty of a sunflower, the glow of a sunset, and the sparkle of a friend's smile. And remember, it's been said that the Buddha's aura extended for 50 miles all around him. Accessing Dreamtime. Many years ago, I worked as a gardener on a 55-acre private garden. From 10 to 10:15 each morning, we had a break, and I would often lie down on a bench for a cat nap. After doing this for many weeks, I began to notice that my body would go to sleep and snore softly, but my mind would stay awake. This realization both fascinated and startled me. I found few people who could relate to this phenomenon. Several years later, a close friend, Paul, told me about a technique he called power napping, which had been used by many famous people, including Thomas Edison and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. President Roosevelt, I was told, would sit at his desk with a small bell in his hand. After closing his eyes, he would relax his thoughts of the day and begin to fall asleep. When he actually fell asleep, he'd drop the bell and wake up again. The process of falling asleep is apparently so energizing to the body that this technique gives the equivalent to an hour nap, though it takes only a few minutes. When I began experimenting with power napping, I noticed that it was essentially the same experience as my cat naps. Later, I began to listen to trance and ritual music from tribal instruments. Planet Drum from Mickey Hart was a favorite. Not only did I find this relaxing, I also began to notice that through my mind's eye, my third eye, my insight, I could travel to different places. Not exactly a dream, not exactly fantasy. In Hatha Yoga, the posture Savasana, or corpse position, is aimed at removing fatigue and calming the mind. One should lie flat on the back with arms angled away from the thighs. The palms should be upturned and the heels are close or touching, with the feet turned out and relaxed. The feet may also be spread apart, allowing the back to fully rest on the floor. The body should be arranged symmetrically. Release all the tensions from the limbs, making sure none is held in the hands, fingers, toes, face, and jaw, etc. The eyes are closed and the vision is turned inward. It is an excellent posture to practice power napping. With different techniques I was introduced to by teachers and books, I began to travel in these layers of consciousness some may call the dream time. Planting your inner garden. There is a stone and a wooden bench with an apple tree shading it. A snake lives under the bench, but is harmless and friendly. In front of the bench, perhaps 2 meters away, starts the garden full of vegetables, flowers, and herbs. This may well describe a garden you have visited, but it is, in this case, some of the inner garden from my dreamtime journeying. What do I mean by inner garden and dreamtime journeying? Dreamtime journeying is one of the results from doing visualization techniques. My inner garden is one of the places I go in my journeys. To go to my inner garden, I can use any one of many techniques. I often use a familiar technique of lying down in a comfortable space and doing several deep, full abdominal breaths. In my mind, I visualize a hole going into the ground. It helps to remember some hole you have seen recently. Going into the hole acts as a passageway into other spaces, inner spaces. Through this hole, you can direct yourself to visit your inner garden. When you wish to come back, you travel back through the tunnel to the here and now. What's so important about having an inner garden? Well, the inner garden is a representation of your well-being. An interesting example of this occurred when I was very sick with a high fever. For about 2 weeks, I was unable to go to my inner garden. It was frustrating and confusing. When I finally found a way to journey there, it appeared that a fire had ravaged the garden, leaving only scorched earth. I brought water from a pond that's there and began to replant what had been lost. As the garden came back, so did my health. When you first begin to venture to your inner garden, simply observe the state of things. Is it overgrown, barren, dry, flooded? Do the plants look healthy? Is there many kinds of plants, or is it all the same? Do you feel comfortable there? Do you feel welcome? Is there some degree of order, balance, harmony? Is it very formal, very wild? These are all indicators of your being that you might otherwise be unaware of. After you have visited your garden several times and feel comfortable traveling back and forth, you can begin to change the garden some. You can work there in the participatory sense, watering, planting, harvesting, but simply being there and wishing for things to change often brings about a significant transformation. Taste the food. How is it? Smell the flowers. Do they have a pleasing fragrance? You can bring plants to your garden by sitting with the physical plant, interacting with it, and asking it to be in your garden. Then, while sitting there, go to your inner garden. If the plant wishes, it will join you there. This plant can be an ally for you. Plants in the dream time can interact with you in many ways. Often they express themselves through an animal, other being, or simply a voice. In this way, you can create an inner garden that can be a sanctuary for you, as well as a place to heal yourself and help others. When going to your inner garden becomes as real for you as your outer garden, though different. It is then time to begin going to the edges of your garden to see what lies beyond. But there is no rush. Experience your inner garden. Begin to learn its secrets and its lessons. See for yourself what it means to have an inner garden. Grow with it over the years and realize that deep down you always knew it was there. Part 3. Vriksha Ayurveda, the Indian healing system of treating plants. The contemporary picture being presented to the world at large of the Indian healing system called Ayurveda, the knowledge of life, is very different from what exists in India now and what has existed there for the past several thousand years. This became apparent during my travels around India, meeting healers and investigating the resources available. Contemporary Ayurveda, as presented to the West, has become a streamlined, product-focused treatment system set up to mimic many Western medical approaches. This is unfortunate, for there is much ancient knowledge that will be lost as the Vaidyas, the name given for traditional healers, continue to die off. The basis of Ayurveda is the Vedas, a collection of four ancient books and a series of books written by famous Vaidyas over the centuries. Charaka Samhita and Sashustra Samhita, to name two. These detail the philosophy, lifestyle suggestions, diagnoses, materia medica, and treatments of Ayurveda. Though the focus is on treating humans, there was much emphasis on treating other animals, called Anayurveda, and plants, Vriksha Ayurveda. The emphasis of this article is to rekindle an interest in Vriksha Ayurveda so that this form of practice and healing will not be lost. The field of Vriksha Ayurveda is a fascinating one. Plants, as living, vibrant beings, are looked at in similar ways to humans in their treatment. This knowledge has all but been discontinued from the contemporary mindset. There are several books and treatises delineating this area of life knowledge. Some include Varahamihira, current era 505, Saragandhara, current era 1363, and Chahavundararya, current era 1025. Much of the writings, to my knowledge, have not been translated to English from Sanskrit. From what I could read, and in my discussions with Vaidyas, there are ways to promote fruiting, keep off pests, heal wounds and burns, promote growth, and increase lifespan, as well as treat specific diseases. There is discussion on proper times to plant and harvest, an explanation of where best to plant, as well as ways living plants can be used in healing. With the world's environment being degraded at an alarming rate and the short-sighted failure of the Green Revolution, which emphasizes chemical treatments and seed hybridization for increasing crop yields, some research has been done to look into the wisdom of Vriksha Ayurveda in the areas of pest and fungus control. In the past 30 years, warns the U.S. National Academy, pesticide use has increased 12-fold, but crop losses due to pests have doubled. Experiments have shown that several fermented herbal decoctions sprayed on plants have been shown to be very effective. The formulae for these decoctions come from the texts on Vriksha Ayurveda. But this is only touching the surface of Vriksha Ayurveda philosophy, much like what is being done with the contemporary Ayurveda, extracting formulae and methods from the greater system of knowledge. But the holistic underlying philosophy of Ayurveda is precisely what needs to be looked at. The alarms are ringing in every corner of the world. Nature is crying, "Wake up!" We need to make some radical switches in the basic tenets of how we as a world are sustaining ourselves. The Western model, instead of reigning supreme, needs to evolve with other powerful healing systems to create a global healing system. Ayurveda generally, and Vriksha Ayurveda in our relationship to plants, presents one powerful foundation for making some of these changes. When you do harvest a plant. As you can see, there is much healing that can be done with a living, vibrant plant. But there are times that the life of a plant needs to be sacrificed to give life to an ailing being. This must not be done lightly or unconsciously, just as you would not want your life, should it be sacrificed, to be taken lightly. First of all, one must ask, have I tried other ways? If so, the next one can ask, can I get the medicine I need without killing the plant? It is often the case that a plant can be asked to make a sacrifice of some part of itself without giving its whole life, a sacrifice it can eventually recover from. This may seem a lot to ask, as we have become desensitized to plants as living, conscious beings. Our ignorance about plants stems partly from their being domesticated with the sole purpose of eating them. If you have taken to heart any of what I have previously said, you will begin to see the intelligence and wisdom of plants, especially plants in the wild, who have maintained communities and a greater purpose than just food for our table. These wild plants are literally bursting with life and wisdom and intelligence. But as I said, there are times that ingesting plants is needed to help us heal. Here proves the fallacy of products with the false notion that you can somehow buy some product that contains the quote-unquote active ingredients that will suffice to aid you. Don't bother. Yes, with medicine made from a healer for you, the healer being a clear, knowledgeable channel, you can get much of the energy of the plant. But each step removed from your actually doing the harvest lessens that energy, what energy gets to you. Remember that when you see all these products in the store, their energy is a mere fraction of what a plant sacrificing its life has to give you. I remember one of my teachers driving this point home on one of our walks. He got down on all fours and grazed a plant right from the ground with his mouth. "That is how you take medicine," he stressed. The act of taking a life to help a life is an important one. Be as close as you can. Do you need to kill the plant to get the medicine? The plant will gladly give its flowers, leaves, and fruit. Won't that do? Usually the answer is yes, and you can go away with a clearer conscience and the plant can go on with its life. But if you need its bark, its roots, its resins, you may need its life. So be it. So be it. The plants are willing to sacrifice for our lives. Once a plant has given its life to save yours, it flows in your veins and is your ally. It is a part of your life. When going to harvest, get away from humanity and its influences as much as possible. Find a community which is prosperous. Be sure it is the right time of year for the medicine to be present. Take the time to sit with the plants. Take the time to explain why you need this medicine and how you believe it can help. Bring along an offering, a sacrifice from you. The Native Americans offer tobacco, but that never registered deeply for me. I have a friend who brings dried fruit because that is the food she loves. So have it be some sacrifice on your part. In addition to food and herbs, I have seen people leave their hair and their saliva. Take the time to look at the community. Ask which plant is ready to go, and one will present itself, usually an elder. Once you have had medicine this way, you will see how much is lost in making mass-produced products. You will feel and know the power of plant medicine. It is both humbling and invigorating to feel the energy of a plant's life roaring through you. Remember, the taking of a life involves karma. Some people believe that is where the side effects of medicines come from the karma in taking a life. At least take that life respectfully and lovingly. I, of course, have not always followed all these suggestions. I have rushed, or have over-harvested, or have not left an offering. I am not proud of that. I have hopefully learned from it. Those times created karma, which I have had to work through. I have always noticed it in the medicine I have made at those times. I pray that experience has taught me to practice what I preach, so I can make the best medicine for my own health and the health of my family. Eating plants. When I sit down to eat, I try to consciously bring to mind the plants before me. I notice that each one of them in turn and visualize where they come from, what they look like growing. I thank them. I also think of all the animals and plants who helped to get this meal before me. When I really think about it, the number becomes astoundingly large. Hundreds of beings join me at the meal and fill me with energy. The dew on flowers seems to be one of the highest forms of energy. Taste it one morning before the sun takes it away. Sip the dew from different flowers and see how that makes you feel. Some people aspire for that to be their only means of sustenance. Others simply enjoy the energy-filled buzz. Fruits and nuts are considered some of the only karmically free food because it doesn't hurt the plant. Enjoy fully the abundant fruits of the plants. Remember to replant the seeds you don't eat. Flowers and leaves can be a wonderful source of energy. Any discomfort to the plants can be easily recovered. Notice your mood while you're picking flowers and leaves. Remember kindness. Do not overpick. When I am out away from human habitats, I nibble constantly. I find it really helps me to bond with the plants. It alters my consciousness, so my senses work differently. I experience things more as a plant does. Taking roots and bark usually involve maiming or even killing the plant. Ask the group of plants you're with for volunteers in some way. Usually elders will come forward. The plants are certainly willing to give their lives for us, but we must see their sacrifice. We need to recognize our needs and be humble to them. Beings are dying so that we may live. Remember that. Eating plants, in addition to being nourished by them, is a way we bond with the plant community. We are never alone. Know where the plants come from. Make sure they are grown with care and love, that their lives were good. In eating them, you are taking on their energy and your body feels what kind of life they led. Eat well, live well. Share your food with those around you and you will never know hunger. Compost what you don't eat and complete the cycle. Your garden will always be fruitful. Postscript. As I reflect on the writings in this booklet, I realize I am asking you to feel compassion for and connection with the plants. But in looking around in this world, I see that we have to start with ourselves, honoring our own body temple and our walk through this life. Only then can we begin helping out and living in a balanced way. Upon looking out, it is clear that this first step of being human has not been developed. For only by being out of balance can we justify our current world. In order to have a steady supply of affordable products, we have set up systems that exploit people and nature. I saw this quite clearly with the plant gatherers and farmers in my travels around the United States and South Asia. These people were the first step in receiving the bounty the world has to offer. The work necessary to gather and grow plants is excessive. These people work long, hard hours and must supply the plants at a price the next rung of the capitalist ladder will pay. This is almost always far below a decent wage for right livelihood. These exploited people are members of a large group of working class people who do the undesirable, unglamorous jobs that are the backbone of contemporary society. Seeing this is a big step towards changing our lives so as not to be excessive in our wants. But what can be done to change these systems? Under the current systems, paying fair wages has some problems with it. First of all, if at every step in the ladder, people were paid fairly, the cost of any product would be beyond most people's means. Secondly, if people doing undesirable jobs were paid well, they would more than likely save up money and do what they could to change careers to something more gratifying. Then how would the undesirable jobs get done? There seems no answer to satisfy the situation. If one is fortunate enough to not be a member of the working class, there is the temptation to remain ignorant of this situation, to live life through the efforts of others. But once one's eyes and heart are opened, each person is compelled to find answers they can live with. To me, it seems we need to do away with these large systems of supplying products. Instead, we can focus on local, cooperative, cottage industries to meet our needs. Also, we need to simplify our lives, finding ways to supply our own needs and doing our share of the undesirable work. This involves being a well-rounded human being. In the United States, we have done a thorough job of separating the white-collar worker from the suffering, sweat, and exploitation of the working class. We have created facades of supermarkets, department stores, convenience centers with products plastic wrapped and sanitized for our consumption. It is easier there to remain ignorant. In Asia, the plight of the working class is more easily seen. The human creation of national boundaries has contributed to this by allowing one country to exploit another. But somehow all this must change. It reflects our past, our present, but it can't reflect our future. It is not sustainable. It is suicidal. Nature is telling us this. What has worked to get us to here will not work much longer. We must deprogram our own mindsets. We must enlighten our beliefs and ways of living based on ignorance. We must change our systems of getting what we want without exploiting ourselves, our fellow humans, the animals, plants, and earth. We must control our population size. We must change, or we as a species will die. Look out at the world and see this for yourself. Start with yourself. Then see what you can do in the world to help us through the labor of birthing a new reality. The plants are here to help. Together we can find a way, and we can keep hope alive. Namaste.